ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय On this 19th day of December 2011 in San Diego, where you're reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 6 entitled Dhyana Yoga, and we are on text 36. Asangyatatmana Yogo Dushprapa iti me matihi Vashyatmana tu yatata Shakyo vaptum upayataha. Translation. For one whose mind is unbridled, self-realization is difficult work. But he whose mind is controlled and who strives by appropriate means is assured of success. That is my opinion. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead declares that one who does not accept the proper treatment to detach the mind from material engagement can hardly achieve success in self-realization. Trying to practice yoga while engaging the mind in material enjoyment is like trying to ignite a fire while pouring water on it. Yoga practice without mental control is a waste of time. Such a show of yoga may be materially lucrative, but it is useless as far as spiritual realization is concerned. Therefore, one must control the mind by engaging it constantly in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Unless one is engaged in Krishna consciousness, he cannot steadily control the mind. A Krishna conscious person easily achieves the result of yoga practice without separate endeavor. But a yoga practitioner cannot achieve success without becoming Krishna conscious. Om Gyana Tamaranda Sir Gyanandana Shalakaya Chukshu Unmiratam Mena Tasmai Shri Yadavena. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torch of knowledge. I offer my obeisance to him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is all about Ashtanga Yoga. Or Dhyana Yoga. Yoga, in Bhagavad Gita, kind of describes what we call a yoga ladder, different kinds of yoga, beginning with Karma Yoga, the yoga of action, in which one tries to work in such a way that one diminishes and one's attachment to the objects of this world. The basic principle of the Vedic understanding is that we experience this round of samsara, which is there in Buddhism and other Eastern religions, birth and death, old age and disease. This is our main problem. We experience that due to our attachment to the things of this world. So Karma Yoga especially deals with the practical actions, how we can work in this world in a detached way, in the mood of sacrifice, without increasing our attachment to the object of this world. But Karma Yoga really becomes more mature when it's informed by knowledge, by transcendental knowledge. And the basic understanding is that we're spirit, we're not matter. That this situation we're in now, in which we all occupy material bodies, is unnatural for the soul or the Atma. That's why Krishna even mentions the Atma several times in this verse. The Atma can have, the word Atma can have different meanings in Sanskrit. The first meaning, basic meaning, is the self. And that is explained at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2. The self is an irreducible particle of spirit or consciousness. And we are part and parcel of the supreme consciousness. So there's a relationship there, like the sun ray to the sun, or the heat to the fire. We're inextricably tied to the supreme consciousness. But because we're minute, we're infinitesimal, we can forget our spiritual nature and identify with the material part of our being, which is this body. And it's not only the gross body, that what we see in the mirror, but also the subtle body, the mind, the intelligence. These are also not us. The soul or the Atma is the observer of everything else. We're actually observing our own minds and our intelligence. It's very subtle. Krishna explains this in chapter 7, next chapter. So all of these things are changing. Our body certainly changes. Everyone can see that. And our thoughts change. Our mind changes. And from moment to moment, it's going. But the soul doesn't change. The soul is never was born and never will die. We ourselves are eternal in both directions. We're irreducible. But certainly we identify ourselves now with a changing and ultimately destructible body. So this attachment, this involvement, entanglement with the material body is meant to be ended by the process of yoga. That's the mission of yoga. And what awaits us? Well, there's liberation from all the sufferings, but beyond that, there's ananda, unending happiness, which we cannot find in this plane because everything is always changing. Along with the happiness comes distress. It's a world of duality. We can see that. So the karma yoga, then there's jnana yoga. Jnana means knowledge. So we have to understand who I am, what is this world, and what is the supreme, you see, and what that relationship is. And then we can begin to act in that relationship. And it involves not only acting selflessly, not karmically or fruitively, but also directing our, trying to develop love for the supreme. And just as this is a basic thing that differentiates Vaishnavism from other forms of Indian religion or Vedic religion or Buddhism and such, and that is that the supreme, that which is the source of everything, which is that supreme consciousness, is ultimately a person. There's a person behind this whole creation. It's practically inconceivable, because what do we know of personhood? Well, we're all individuals. We're minute. We have our limitations. But this is a person beyond limitations. In the little formula that you get from Western theology, omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent, which is very awe-inspiring if you actually think of all the implications. So then there's karma yoga, jnana yoga, and then this is dhyana yoga. This is going up the ladder. Now, the dhyana yogi, this is the traditional yoga that we learn about, where you sit and you meditate, you control the breath, the pranayama. Have each of you practiced some yoga? Yeah. Did I ever do a little pranayama? Ever do that? Would it calm the mind, sit for meditation? You do that, right? I used to do it. Anyway, maybe you didn't. But that's an integral part of it. Even in Western yoga, they do that. It's very purifying for the health and clearing the mind. It's very good, pranayama. And even some of my friends, you may not know this, in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, there's some recommendation for pranayama, to calm the mind so that one can better focus the mind on the mantra. And this is where, I'll explain in a minute, in relation to dhyana yoga and the other yogas, where the chanting of mantra comes in, and especially this maha mantra. So dhyana yoga, or what we call ashtanga yoga, ashtanga means eight limbs. Eight phases of yoga. And this is the traditional, as explained in these Patanjali sutras. Patanjali was the authority on this Ashtanga yoga. He lived many thousands of years ago. And he wrote these sutras. They're little instructions that are then expanded. And they form the canon for those who are serious about this kind of yoga. So the eight limbs are this. It's called, the first two are Yama and Niyama. Now Yama and Niyama are kind of the ethical principles that underlie this form of yoga. And that Prabhupada mentions it here in this purport, is that you can't lead a dissolute life, The idea is to control the senses, control the mind, and fix it on the transcendence. Can you see what the commotion is out there? Maybe we can. Hare Krishna. And focus the mind. The whole idea, dhyana means meditation, which culminates in samadhi, which is complete focus. So it begins with these ethical principles. And, one is that self-control. No intoxication, no gambling. This is what we practice. These are basic things. And also controlling the senses, controlling the sex life. That is one of the things. That's why you find, the celibacy is there. But even without celibacy, there has to be control and not letting it out, because then the mind becomes very disturbed. So yama niya, rules and regulations. And Krishna gives a little summary here in the sixth chapter. And then comes asana. This is practicing sitting, sitting with your back straight in a very balanced way. That's also important for meditation. And then comes this pranayama, controlling the mind, controlling the mind through the breath, watching the breath, counting the breath, and in this way, calming everything. And then pratyahara, this is the fifth step, fifth step, and that is withdrawing the senses, you know, from their objects. And that includes imagining and fantasizing about things, you know. So it's pretty austere, because generally it takes place, as Krishna says, out in the jungle, in the cave somewhere. You know, you've heard about the yogis in the Himalayas and everything. That's what it's describing. So you have yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara. Then comes dharana. And dharana means the effort to concentrate. Generally, the yogis, they'll look in within the heart. They'll focus their attention within the heart. Or they'll try on the different chakras. You heard of these eight chakras, you know, on the spine. Nodes of energy, you know, trying to bring the energy up the chakras. So that's not an easy thing to do, you know, to sit for hours really at a time, you know, very austere, and focus the mind. Minds want to focus it again, bring it back. And then if one achieves that, some, you know, kind of steadiness, that's called dhyan, and that's the title of this chapter, which means meditation. And if one achieves perfect concentration and absorption in the Lord in the heart, if you will, then that's called samadhi. And these are the eight principles of Ashtanga Yoga. Now, this whole Bhagavad Gita is taking place as a conversation on a battlefield. He said, talking about yoga and meditation on a battlefield, so it seems incongruous. But it becomes clear at the end of this chapter, because the dialogue is between Arjuna and Krishna. It's part of a larger work called the Mahabharata. And what Krishna is doing here, he's summarizing all the Upanishadic knowledge, the Vedic knowledge, the essential philosophical knowledge. And so Arjuna, he represents us. And he's an intimate friend of Krishna, but he's been covered by illusion. And now he's asking pertinent questions. So what he says just a few verses back, he says, Krishna, I don't think I can do this. You know, the mind is so powerful, it's like trying to control the wind. I can't just go and sit, you know, for hours like that. I don't see how it's possible. And so now Krishna is answering that, and he's saying it is possible by, undoubtedly it's very difficult, he says in the previous verse, but by practice you can do it. And in the present verse, he says, yeah, if the mind is unbridled, self-realization is very difficult. But for one whose mind is controlled and who strives by appropriate means is assured of success, that is my opinion. So he's encouraging Arjuna to understand that it is possible. But Arjuna, again, will appeal, you know, in a different way. Say, well, what if I'm unsuccessful? What if I try and fail? You know, did I just waste my time? I gave up my, you know, life as a kshatriya or whatever, as a warrior, and now I went off to the forest and I failed, and I lost in both. And Krishna says, don't worry about it. He says, you'll be reborn, because reincarnation is essential, and you'll pick up where you left off. So there's no loss. But still, it's a very difficult road to hoe. And throughout these purports, these are commentaries that our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, wrote, he explains that in this age, if we want to achieve what could be achieved by this Ashtanga Yoga, only a very few people can actually achieve, can be successful. But the process of Bhakti Yoga, centering on the chanting of the holy name, easily attracts the mind, and one can become absorbed in the transcendence in the form of the holy name, in the form of this Maha Mantra. And so that will be explained at the very end of the chapter, that Bhakti Yoga, the yoga of loving devotion to Krishna, who is the source of everything, is really the best form of meditation in this age. And it includes Jnana Yoga, and it includes Karma Yoga. It is the top of the ladder. And so that will become clear soon. So just to review this purport, one has to accept a proper treatment. In other words, we live in an age called Kali Yuga. The Vedic understanding is that there's a cycle of ages, just like the seasons. And we're in like the winter age. Or you can think of it as the golden age, the silver age, the brass age, and the iron age. We're in the iron age, you know. So this is not that great an age for self-realization and spiritual life. It's and some of the reasons are given. We don't live that long, compared to previous ages, when they lived very regulated lives, you know, the air was pure, the water was pure. We're so compromised. And most important is, there's so much agitation. There's so much disruption of life. Even if you think you have it together a little bit, just like You know, everyone knows about this economic thing we've been going through for 3 years. So many thousands and even millions of people who are approaching old age or in their 50s, you know, I've got it together, you know, I've got my retirement, I've got my house, you know, and suddenly it's up in the air. You know, you can imagine, or maybe you've experienced the mental difficulty, the anxiety that produces. So how can you tell someone like that, okay, now we have to practice meditation? It's not going to happen, right? So that's going on all over, and it's been that way forever. You know, I mean, when has there been a period? You go back into the 20th century. I mean, I go back a fair ways into the 20th century. I grew up in the 60s, you know. And there was always some war. There was always some threat. It was the draft, you know. And then you know, terrorism came up. And all this time, you know, now we forget it. You may be too young to remember the Cold War, you know. The Cold War meant that the Soviet Union, you know, and for a kid growing up, it looks like they're taking over the earth. There's this big Soviet Union, and there's the Red China, and they practically have half the earth, you know, and they colored it red, and they have all of these nuclear bombs, you know, and they're ready to fall at a moment's notice. They got the, you know, there's the button. And I'm growing up, you know, how can you have a peaceful, you know, mind? I mean, the last thing in the world you think about is meditation, right? But that's a necessity. Otherwise, you're going to go around and around and really suffer in this world. You know? So that's the age we're in. So how, in the middle of all of this, can we practice yoga? That will be described as this Bhagavad Gita goes on. So Arjuna, so we have to take the right practice. We have to, you know, take it in the right way. So we shouldn't be fooled. You know, yoga is very good. Hatha yoga is good. It keeps you, you know, healthy. I used to practice it every day for that. I've given it up a little bit. But there's no problem with that. But our mission in life, there is a goal for the soul, and that is to break free of the bonds of matter and to be, again, you know, absorbed in the pure spiritual world where there's no birth, no death, just an endless world of blissful, loving exchanges with the Supreme. That's the reality that's being given. So, Krishna will continue here. Any questions on these few points? Okay, we can proceed. Arjuna asks, Arjuna Vacha, Ayati Shadayopeto, Yoga Chalita Manasaha, Aprapa Yoga Sangsiddhim, Kam Gatim Krishna Gachati. Arjuna said, O Krishna, what is the destination of the unsuccessful transcendentalist who in the beginning takes to the process of self-realization with faith, but who later desists due to worldly-mindedness and thus does not attain perfection in mysticism? Purport. The path of self-realization or mysticism is described in the Bhagavad Gita. The basic principle of self-realization is knowledge that the living entity is not this material body, but that he is different from it, and that his happiness is in eternal life, bliss, and knowledge. These are transcendental beyond both body and mind. Self-realization is sought by the path of knowledge, by the practice of the Eightfold System, or by Bhakti Yoga. In each of these processes, one has to realize the constitutional position of the living entity. Now, just to review, that's Jnana Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga mentioned there. You see? In each of these processes, one has to realize the constitutional position of the living entity, his relationship with God, and the activities whereby he can reestablish the lost link and achieve the highest perfectional stage of Krishna consciousness. Following any of the above-mentioned three methods, one is sure to reach the supreme goal sooner or later. This was asserted by the Lord in the second chapter. Even a little endeavor on the transcendental path offers a great hope for deliverance. Out of these three methods, the path of Bhakti Yoga is especially suitable for this age because it is the most direct method of God-realization. To be doubly assured, Arjuna is asking Lord Krishna to confirm his former statement. One may sincerely accept the path of self-realization, but the process of cultivation of knowledge and the practice of the Eightfold Yoga System are generally very difficult for this age. Therefore, despite constant endeavor, one may fail for many reasons. First of all, one may not be sufficiently serious about following the process. To pursue the transcendental path is more or less to declare war on the illusory energy. Consequently, whenever a person tries to escape the clutches of the illusory energy, she tries to defeat the practitioner by various allurements. A conditioned soul is already allured by the modes of material energy, and there is every chance of being allured again, even while performing transcendental disciplines. This is called yogat cholita manasa, deviation from the transcendental path. Arjuna is inquisitive to know the results of deviation from the path of self-realization. Is that door, that closet door is closed completely? Okay. So, here Arjuna is expressing a doubt, like I mentioned, that he feels that the mind, his mind will probably be deviated, and what will be his would be the result? What happens to someone? So Krishna will be very encouraging, and he, and Prabhupada mentions the second chapter there, is that the path of yoga, especially bhakti yoga, there's no loss or diminution. If you begin, even if you begin the path, then that's in your eternal bank account, so to speak, spiritual bank account. And even if you just do, you know, a little chanting or whatever, a little practice of bhakti yoga, and you forget about the rest of your life, that's in your mind. It's there in your memory. You know, everything we've done is actually recorded, although we can't access it right now. And so that will mean that in your next life, you begin where you left off. So there's no loss or diminution. But still, why should we prolong the process? We should try to achieve the success in one lifetime. You know, but the idea is that there is no loss in taking up the process. The loss comes from not taking up the process and being assured of birth and death for, you know, perpetually. So this is the auspicious path. And then, you know, Prabhupada talks about the different processes here. And this is a very telling statement. To pursue the transcendental path is more or less to declare war on the illusory energy. So, you know, the Vedic view is that there is a person behind everything. The Western rationalistic reductionist scientific view is ultimately that there's no person. You know, who am I? Oh, well, my consciousness is just a result of these very complex, you know, firings of neurons in the brain. And we can manipulate it by drugs or surgery or whatever, and this way we can change your personality. Right? If I'm depressed, I take this pill. If I can't go to sleep, take that pill. If I can't get up, take that pill. So pills are just chemicals. They do something to the brain chemistry. And in this way, they change your consciousness. Right? So consciousness, we haven't figured it out completely yet, obviously. It's very complex. But consciousness is a result of complex interactions of matter. But the Vedic view is just the opposite, is that personality pervades everything. That in every atom, there is an expansion of the personality of God. Nothing happens without a person behind it. We can't tell. Just like if an ant is walking in this door, right, and happens to come up and gets on my knee here, I don't notice the ant. I'm just going on. What does that ant know of me as a person? He knows there's a different terrain here, you know, there's a slight color difference, you know, and you can tell there's a big mountain to climb up there, you know. Yeah, I had no idea that there's a person here behind all this. And that's what I am. I mean, I'm just a conglomeration of matter, as far as he knows, right? And so that's what we see also in this world. I mean, we see each other as persons, obviously. But mostly we see impersonal matter. But we should understand from the Vedic knowledge, from this you know, authoritative view, which has been given by realized saints, that there is a personality, there is consciousness everywhere, behind everything, and so so behind this, what was probably called the illusory energy, the material energy, which keeps us bound here. And convinces us beyond a doubt that we are this body, that this is who I am. Right? If someone asks, who are you, the ordinary person, you say, well, you give a name. You know? Or if the cop stops you on the street, right? You ran a red light or you're speeding. All right. License and registration, please, ma'am. And then you give your license and he looks at the picture. Right? Matches up. And there's a name there. So we've got two things now. We've got a name. And we got the picture, we got the form, right? But it also describes a little bit. The hair is brown, the eyes are blue, the weight, the age, the address, isn't it? So actually there are four things that describe a person. The name. First is the name. But there's also what they look like, right? The description, picture, whatever. But there's also what are they like? What you know, are they happy? Are they sad? Are they intelligent? Are they dumb? You know, the qualities that someone has. They like to play the violin, they like to play the trombone, the guitar, and this and that. There's all kinds of things. Then you really know the person more. And what they do, their activities. Four things. The name, the form, the qualities, and the activities. And then you figure you know somebody, you know, fairly well. I mean, you can't know them completely. They're very complex, right? So there is a personality behind this illusory energy. And that is just like you may have heard of Durga. You ever heard of Shiva? Lord Shiva? Shiva, he is married. His wife is Durga. And Durga is personified material energy. Now, she is a great saint, devotee. She's, you know, goddess. But her job is to bewilder us. The material energy bewilder us. With all kinds of allurements, as Prabhupada says, and illusory philosophies, and understanding, thinking we're this body and our place is here and all of these things. So that's called Durga or Maya. Maya means that which is not. But Krishna, he wants us to be enlightened. And so he comes and he teaches Bhagavad Gita. He sends his representatives, such as the great saints like Srila Prabhupada. And since Durga is, after all, a servant of Krishna, that if we turn to Krishna and we understand his philosophy and we chant this mantra and we practice bhakti yoga, then she withdraws the illusory curtain and we can understand who we really are. That we're Satchitananda. We're eternal, we're full of bliss, we're full of knowledge. And if we act that way, under proper instruction, we have to have a guru, then we can stay on that enlightened platform. And Maya will not bewilder us. But along the path, there's a path, there's a marga, bhakti marga. Just like anything, you want to learn to play the violin, there's a path. And at the end of the path, you're playing excellently. But if along the way, and you know, millions of kids who take up the violin say, oh, it's too hard to give it up, right? Then they're not going to succeed. So the same thing is true in yoga. So that's the question, Arjun. What happens if I go off the path? It's called yoga brashta, breaking your yoga. You know, allurements are always there. We're not serious. So Krishna will ask that, will answer that question. Arjun goes on for a couple of more verses here, asking his question. Kachin nobaya vibrashtas chinnab. Go ahead. Kachin nobaya vibrashtas chinnabram ivanashyati apatishto mahabaho vimudho brahmanakpati. Almighty Yam Krishna, does not such a man or person who is bewildered from the path of transcendence fall away from both spiritual and material success and perish like a riven cloud with no position in any sphere? That's a good question. There are two ways to progress. Those who are materialists have no interest in transcendence. Therefore, they are more interested in material advancement by economic development or in promotion to the higher planets by appropriate work. When one takes to the path of transcendence, one has to cease all material activities and sacrifice all forms of so-called material happiness. If the aspiring transcendentalist fails, then he apparently loses both ways. In other words, he can enjoy neither material happiness nor spiritual success. He has no position. He is like a riven cloud. A cloud in the sky sometimes deviates from a small cloud and joins a big one. But if it cannot join a big one, then it is blown away by the wind and becomes a non-entity in the vast sky. The Brahmanapati is the path of transcendental realization through knowing oneself to be spiritual in essence, part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, who is manifested as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Lord Sri Krishna is the fullest manifestation of the Supreme Absolute Truth, and therefore one who is surrendered to the Supreme Person is a successful transcendentalist. To reach this goal of life through Brahman and Paramatma realization takes many, many births, bahunam janmanam ante. Therefore, the supermost path of transcendental realization is bhakti yoga, or Krishna consciousness, the direct method. So Prabhupada refers to Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. These are different manifestations, progressive manifestations of the absolute truth, we say. Brahman is like that famous kind of white light, is the all-pervading spiritual light. We can't perceive with our present vision, but it's pure spirit, but there's no variety. There's no person, there's no activities, it's just pure awareness, consciousness. And this is said to be very bright and very enlightening. That's why you have this word enlightening. But in the Vedic understanding, this white light is actually emanating from the form of Krishna. You see? So beyond that white light is the all-pervading but localized aspect of Krishna, known as Paramatma, the Supreme Soul. In every one of our hearts, the Supreme Soul is there. The same Supreme Soul. And what does he do? He gives us intelligence. He reminds us of what we want to do to fulfill our karma from previous life. In general, he gives knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness too. If we didn't have forgetfulness, we couldn't really live. Just like there's something called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Someone gets it, you know, the soldiers come back from Iraq or somewhere, a lot of them, they may have that. So it's very disorienting, you know, it affects your consciousness, your way of living in this world, it's difficult. So, and it comes from some trauma. So we've all been through so many traumas, you know, luckily we can't remember it. Our last death, how traumatic that was. You know, and birth, I don't remember it. I don't think anyone here does. And, you know, so many diseases, shocks, these all happen in previous lives, not just one life. And they're all forgotten blissfully. We can go on without, you know, peacefully in this life. So that's what the Super Soul does. He guides us, and he's trying to give good instruction. The same instruction that Krishna gives here, Super Soul is giving us. When we have the conscience, like we all know, you know, I mean, it's kind of a given that you shouldn't exploit children. You shouldn't abuse them, right? I mean, someone's a monster if they do that, right? So each of us has something in our mind that says, "Oh, this is horrible." You know, this is like the Super Soul. This is called the conscience. If you hurt your friend, you feel bad about it, right? If you steal something, that's the conscience. That's the Super Soul, who's absolute good. Now, many people, like they disobey, they are so dark and they're in a different low mode of nature that they shut out that conscience and they become amoral people. You know, there are people like that. But the Super Soul is still there, you know, and it's giving and it's guiding us. And not just in the human life, every form of life, which we can also enter and have been through. This is another amazing understanding, is that human form of life is the highest, you know, on this plane, development of consciousness. But there are much lower forms of consciousness. The dogs, the cats, the insects, they all have souls. And Super Soul is there, telling it how to be a grasshopper, how to be a dog, how to be a plant even. There's some intelligence, very rudimentary. You know. So now we have this human form of life. What a rare gift. We shouldn't waste it in animal propensities. We should really reach our potential. I remember there was this fellow, Abraham Maslow, who also talked about self-actualization. You know? That's a very good phrase. Like we have this self-discovery, journey to self-discovery. That's really what we should aspire for, the quest for enlightenment. That's the human mission. Not just to, you know, eat and sleep and have sex and defend ourselves. You know, the animals do that. But what they don't do and they can't do because they don't have the intelligence is to strive for this kind of knowledge and realization. Really evolve the consciousness to reach superconsciousness. Prabhupada uses that phrase, superconsciousness. He uses that term. So, Brahman, Paramatma, that's the secondary understanding. But the supreme understanding of the Absolute is Bhagavan. But Prabhupada said the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He has all the lila, the beautiful form, all attractive, and the pastimes. He has a place, you know, and he's the source of everything. Everything that exists is emanating, and we're part and parcel. So there's a lot of to understand, but that relationship, reawakening ourselves to the relationship with Bhagavan, that's the mission of human life, and that's what bhakti is all about. Okay, one more doubt here from Arjun. Etanme sankshayam Krishna. Chaitumarhasya sheshataha Tvaranya Sankshayasya Yasya. Chaitana Upapadyate. This is my doubt, O Krishna, and I ask you to dispel it completely. But for you, no one is to be found who can destroy this doubt. Purport. Krishna is the perfect knower of past, present, and future. In the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord said that all living entities existed individually in the past, they exist now in the present, and they continue to retain individual identity in the future, even after liberation. From the material entanglement, so he, Krishna, has already cleared up the question of the future of the individual living entity. Now, Arjuna wants to know of the future of the unsuccessful transcendentalist. No one is equal to or above Krishna, and certainly the so-called great sages and philosophers who are at the mercy of the material nature cannot equal him. Therefore, the verdict of Krishna is the final and complete answer to all doubts, because he knows past, present, and future perfectly, but no one knows him. Krishna and Krishna-conscious devotees alone can know what is what. So this is the doubts. You know, the doubts are kind of our enemies. And that's why faith is so important. And faith is nourished by knowledge and also by associating with the faithful. And wonderfully also by direct experience. This chanting of this mantra is not an ordinary thing. If God is all-powerful and he wants to reach out to us, this is one of the understandings, is that we're all children of God. Right? We're all part and parcel. And we're kind of wandering in this world, suffering old age, disease, death repeatedly, you know, undoubtedly. But we have a birthright in the spiritual world, where there's no birth, no old age, no death. That's Ananda. So we're like wayward children, prodigal sons and daughters, you know. So Krishna wants to bring us back. It's a very kind of, you know, we can easily understand it, intuit it. So he reaches out in various ways that make himself accessible, and one of the most important way in this age is through his name, the sound. Sounds are so important for our consciousness. We all know the effect that music can have on us, right? Different kinds of music, different kinds of words. If our friend praises us, you know, oh, we feel good. But if they insult us, we feel terrible, right? Words, sounds, so much is carried through that. So the name, this name, especially this mantra, contains the Shakti of Krishna, especially Bhakti Shakti. It's especially can awaken this Bhakti that's been mentioned here, Bhakti Yoga. Because after all, what are we looking for in this world? We're looking for love. We're looking for pleasure in a loving relationship. And even with the inanimate things, you know, we'll use that word loosely, right? Oh, I love that shawl. I love that game. I love this. I love that, right? We're looking to try to relate to the world through animate as well as inanimate things. But there's something missing. There's like a curve that develops, especially during this Christmas time. Every parent knows it, right? They take the kid into the toy store, and last year's toys are lying on the floor, right? But these are the new toys, and what everyone's getting, and they gotta have it. The parents lay out so many thousands of dollars, and then Christmas morning, oh, you know, my parents love me so much; they bought me what I want. The parents are happy, the kids are happy. That's great, you know. But then time goes, and before you know it, those toys are thrown apart. They need new toys, right? This is the way of this world. And unfortunately, it also works with relationships. I mean, when you get older, you can look back on your life and you say, oh, you know, this was the one, that was the one, this is what happened. You know, there's nothing is static, everything is changing, and it's all being degraded by time, you know. So to get to that point of Satchidananda, that where there is no degradation, where everything is eternally fresh and new, everything, you know, every experience and relationship and so forth, that's what we're trying to get to. And but we have doubts. I don't see it. You know, that, so therefore we need to be exposed to those who have faith and experience. And by a little chanting of this mantra, and I hope, if you, can you stay until the aarti? Okay, so at 8:15 you'll get a little sample. The curtains will open, you see the deities, and we'll chant Hare Krishna. So if you try chanting, you know, try the sound vibration, listening and chanting, it works every time. It's just a force. Just like, you know, if you drink some water, it'll quench your thirst. But you have to have faith that if you drink the water, most of us do because we've had experience since childhood, right? But the same thing is true of this. But because it's a little alien, you don't understand it. But it actually works. And so that helps build the faith that there's something out there. Because this mantra, yeah, there's something to it. You know. But knowledge and association is also what brings faith. So this is what, it's just the opposite of doubt. So Arjuna is saying, please, you can dispel this doubt of mine. Will I lose both, you know, spheres? I won't get anything material, I won't get anything spiritual. And Krishna will encourage his friend Arjuna here. That no, you will not lose by this process. There is no loss, you know. Take it up full-heartedly or take it up half-heartedly, but take it up somehow, you know, and you'll be benefited. Okay, any questions on this? The next is kind of a long one, and I think we can't deal with it. Unfortunately, well, tomorrow night, we'll deal with this, but then I'm off to Chicago for a week. Some people go to Florida. I'm going to Chicago for a vacation. Middle of winter. I was invited to speak there with, you know, some people. So. Wednesday. So tomorrow we'll have class. It's a Kadashi special day tomorrow. So. Okay, so we'll adjourn and get ready for our little RT. RT is the ceremony we're going to have. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.